Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Two friends I have known nearly 50 years have contributed to today's program, David Horowitz, a 2020 perspective, and Joseph Stevenson, a Wolfpack rallying cry from its national director, Allison Hutchinson. We start with David. 2020 vision and the progressive search for a viable strategy. It now seems obvious that the Republican Party has disqualified itself as a morally accountable force in American politics. Its refusal to deal with the challenges of climate change, its associations with a vicious and life-threatening health care proposal designed to provide tax cuts for the wealthy, and the reluctance of most of its base and leadership to distance itself from the erosion of the rule of law in the Trump administration are only the latest symptoms of a faction whose only reason for being lies in its desire to inspire the outrage of liberals. As progressives search for a fruitful response to the present administration's assault on the civic state, however, two caveats must be kept in mind. First, it would be foolish to anticipate a first-term impeachment. Admittedly, Donald Trump has an uncanny ability to sabotage his own legitimacy and may have obstructed justice as the FBI investigates the relationship of his campaign with Russian interests. Yet the requirements for corroborating high crimes are daunting. Despite the testimony of former White House counselor John Dean, remember, it took the Oval Office tapes to force Richard Nixon to resign. Don't count on a repeat. Trump's taunt about his own taping system most likely was a bluff to intimidate former FBI Director James Comey from testifying today about their private conversations. Add to that, Republicans control both houses of Congress, and it takes a two-thirds vote of the Senate to convict a president of impeachment. The second caveat concerns Democratic chances of winning Congress in 2018. It's true that chances of a Democratic takeover of the House improve each day. Generic preference polling now stands at +5 in their favor. Given gerrymandering, they need a +8 rating to pick up the 24 seats they would need. Given the reawakened Democratic base, this is not realistic. Yet the Senate will almost certainly remain Republican, since Democrats hold most of the seats up for election. Conceivably, Democratic incumbents could hold Trump states like West Virginia, Montana, North Dakota, Ohio, Florida, and Missouri. But Indiana, where the Democrats won in 2012 with only 49% of the vote after the Republican candidate talked about real rape, might be a stretch. Even if Democrats held all their seats, they would still need to pick up 3 Republican seats to get a 51-seat majority. There is a reasonable opportunity to oust Heller in Nevada and Flake in Arizona for 2. Beyond that, it's hard to find a third unless Maine's Susan Collins decides against running for governor in 2018 and joins her counterpart, Angus King, and declares herself an independent who will caucus with the Democrats. If the Democrats won the House in 2018, they could stymie the remnants of a Trump agenda. Yet real political realignment will have to wait until 2020, when far more Republican senators than Democrats, many in blue states, will face re-election, and Democrats will likely attract a hefty presidential election year turnout. Still, if all of this is to work, the party will need to field a presidential candidate who can inspire disciplined unity within the ranks while attracting enough of an emotionally shattered and divisive general electorate to take back the White House. Along these lines, some figures from the 2016 election are instructive. Hillary Clinton lost the Electoral College when Donald Trump outpolled her by a total of 78,000 votes in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. 60,000 of that 78,000 vote margin came from the Green and Libertarian parties, increasing their 2012 vote by 500,000. Trump picked up only 440,000 more votes in those 3 states than Romney in 2012. In Wisconsin, Trump beat Hillary by 23,000 votes. Jill Stein's Green Party won 31,000 votes. Clinton's Wisconsin vote was 193,000, less than Obama's in 2012, with more than half of the white share of that number voting Green or Libertarian. In Michigan, Trump beat Hillary by less than 13,000 votes. Jill Stein's Green Party won 51,000 votes in a state where the white vote for third and fourth parties increased fivefold from 2012. Pennsylvania offered a different picture. Clinton actually improved Obama's 2012 white vote, but 130,000 fewer black votes cast a ballot than in 2012. Hillary lost the state by 44,000 votes. There are some disturbing implications to these numbers for progressives. Green Party voters who didn't trust Clinton on the environment now face an administration intent on dismembering every federal program designed to protect the environment and ameliorate the effects of climate change. Progressives who didn't trust Hillary's incremental commitment to universal health care now face an administration intent on dismembering the Affordable Health Care Act to advantage wealthy donors. Critics who question Clinton's relationship to Wall Street and her commitment to economic equity now face an administration dedicated to the wholesale eradication of financial and industrial regulation and public protections, the imposition of tax cuts for the wealthy, and the institutionalization of greed and predatory behavior as the unquestioned foundation of American life. Social justice activists, including some African Americans and Hispanics, who question Clinton's commitment to humane immigration reform and the reduction of police abuse, mass incarceration, and punitive drug practices, now face what may be the most repressive Justice Department in U.S. history. The point is not to relitigate the 2016 election or suggest that Clinton was the perfect candidate, nor is it to deny that Democrats need to align with working class and middle class Americans while addressing the nation's ethnic and cultural diversity. Yet the party needs to do so in a way that goes beyond the favorite ideological fixations of its base, such as doing away with large banks or promoting the rapid adoption of a single-payer health system, and instead addresses voters where they find them. As the country moves toward 2020 after a divisive and stressful presidency, voters will be looking for calm reassurance that a semblance of sanity can be restored in Washington. At that point, a presidential candidate's personal qualities may matter far more than any explicit program. This would require someone with emotional and intellectual maturity, a healer who speaks softly but passionately about the values of cooperation and mutual respect that most Americans cherish. The last thing the electorate will seek is another round of divisive political rhetoric that only convinces people that politics has nothing to do with their lives. When large numbers of voters become apathetic, conservatives win, and nothing ever changes for the better. The right candidate, however, may provide the chance to bring a semblance of unity and a desperately needed degree of accomplishment to a broken and dispirited political system. And that is 2020 Vision and the Progressive Search for a Viable Strategy by David A. Horowitz, who is professor of U.S. culture and political history at Portland State University and author of America's Political Class Under Fire, The 20th Century's Great Culture War in 2003, and a memoir, Getting There, An American Cultural Odyssey in 2015. And now, by Allison Hartson, The Logical Path to End Corruption. I used to tell my students that my number one goal for them was not to memorize any one author or event from the stories we analyzed or the history we studied, but for them to learn to be critical thinkers. A big part of critical thinking is being genuinely open-minded to all sides of an argument. Know your biases, know others, read and listen to information, especially that with which you disagree, and do so with compassion. Then, based on all that information, come to your own conclusion. That is how I decided to put my career on hold as a high school teacher and instead work with a political organization, Wolfpack, PAC capitalized, that is using what I view as a necessary strategy to solve the most pressing issue of our time, the disproportionate influence of money on our political system. Look no farther than this last presidential election cycle, where both sides ran their campaign platforms on this issue, to see how cross-partisan it is. They use different catchphrases, getting big money out of politics, or draining the swamp, but they were both talking about the same thing, the corruption happening in D.C., where good people run for office and then get consumed by a system that has been left largely unchecked and unaccountable to we the people. Research proves that we have all been sensing for a long time the root cause of so many of the problems that exist in our country: environment, education, healthcare, economy, freedom, privacy, is the way in which money is able to buy access and therefore disproportionately influence policymakers in America. Despite the writing on the wall, I do not believe that it is too late, but I do believe that we must do every single thing in our power right now to correct this trajectory while we still can, or else the centuries-old experiment of democracy in America could fail. It is that serious, which is precisely why I made the difficult decision to upend my life as a high school teacher and work on this plan full time. Wolfpack has but one goal: to get an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that will reverse the damage that has been done by the U.S. Supreme Court around campaign finance reform. The solution to this problem is an amendment, because the U.S. Constitution is the only authority above the High Court. Anything less is a band-aid, and I refuse to leave this growing problem to future generations. An amendment that addresses campaign finance reform is not a silver bullet. Few things in life are, but it is an extremely important step to moving our country in the direction it needs to go, towards elections that are free of the corrupting influence of money in our political system, and fair enough that any citizen can run for office, not just millionaires and their allies. There are only two ways to propose a constitutional amendment, as stated in Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. 1. Two-thirds of each House of Congress can vote to propose an amendment, or 2. Two-thirds of the states, 34 states, can pass a resolution that calls for a national convention to propose an amendment. Article 5 also states that either way the amendment is proposed, whether by Congress or a convention, it then goes back to the states for approval, also known as ratification. The ratification stage requires 3/4 of the states, 38 states, to vote in support of an amendment before it becomes part of the Constitution, ensuring that it must have broad public support from the American people. It is generally well known that all 27 of our constitutional amendments were proposed by Congress. What is not well known is that more than half of those amendments were initiated by calls for an Article 5 convention, including the Bill of Rights. History shows us that pressure from the states is an important and effective check against the federal government. It is essential that we learn from history, and the most popular example of this strategy working effectively is the 17th Amendment. When Congress refused to change the way they were elected, the states began applying for an Article 5 convention for the specific purpose of the direct election of senators. When they got within a couple of states of the two-thirds needed to force a convention on the subject, Congress decided to act and propose the amendment out to the states for ratification. With history as its guide, Wolfpack was formed to achieve its goal of getting a free and fair elections amendment to the U.S. Constitution. In 2014, our volunteers worked with state legislators to pass binding resolutions in 3 states that call for an Article 5 convention to propose an amendment dealing with the issue of campaign finance reform. And in just 1 year, we had opposition working behind the scenes to stop us. Since then, we have passed our resolution in 2 more states, but the same opposition is working overtime to rescind our resolutions and erase the hard work of all our volunteers and the state legislators who have fought to get big money out of politics. And the opposition may not be who you would think. Common Cause, a political organization founded in 1970, says that one of its main issues to end the corrupting influence of big money in our political system through a constitutional amendment. They send petitions and fundraising mailers with these claims. At the same time, they use their resources to send lobbyists into the states we work in with our volunteers in order to stop our legislation. Apparently, Common Cause has found common cause with an extremist right-wing conspiracy theorist group, the John Birch Society. Co-founded in 1958 by the Koch brothers' father, Fred Koch, the John Birch Society was denounced by the Republican National Committee as early as 1965. They are notorious for their conspiracy propaganda, including communist accusations against President Dwight Eisenhower, the U.S. Supreme Court, and the civil rights movement. Their fears of the fluoridation of water were the inspiration behind the men who destroyed the world, the man, pardon me, who destroyed the world in Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove. The John Birch Society is also the group that started the conspiracy theory around the Article 5 Convention. Their propaganda centers around what they call a runaway convention. In the 1960s, a movement was underway for a limited Article 5 convention to address the Supreme Court case Reynolds versus Sims, which ruled that legislative districts must have generally equal populations within each chamber of the legislature of each state. Prior to that case, many states had one house that was wildly disproportionate, like the Senate at the federal level. In the age before the internet, a covert lobbying effort led to 33 states to call for an Article 5 convention on this issue in only about 5 years. In order to quickly stop this amendment from being proposed, many other credible people on both the political left and right adopted the John Birch Society conspirational propaganda. Rather than arguing the merits of the amendment, they simply spread fear about the path of a limited Article 5 convention. That tactic has continued to be used by the John Birch Society, and now by Common Cause. On January 25, 2016, the John Birch Society published an article calling on states to rescind their Article 5 convention applications. Common Cause is now doing the same. Common Cause and the John Birch Society claim that a convention cannot be limited to a single issue, despite mounds of evidence provided by scholars to disprove the hypothesis. Opponents tend to leave out of their argument the fact that the Constitution cannot under any circumstances be changed or amended at a convention called under Article 5. When people use the term constitutional convention or runaway convention to warn that it will take away our Second Amendment rights, gut Social Security or Medicaid, or reinstate slavery, they actually make this obviously outrageous and offensive claim. What they appear to imply is that the convention cannot only propose amendments but also ratify them. When their runaway hypothesis is countered with the ratification check against any proposed amendment, they will claim that the convention can simply lower the ratification threshold. That is not true. Article 5 states clearly that 3/4 of the states must ratify any amendment proposed by Congress or a convention. Changing the ratification threshold would require an amendment to the Constitution, which would require 75% of the states to approve before it could be lowered. This is not debatable, and is so plainly wrong it makes one wonder if you can trust anything they say. It is fear-mongering and demagoguery run amok. Opponents to an Article 5 convention would like us to be terrified of using the Constitution to guide our country towards real change. Instead, they ask us to support the status quo by relying on Congress to fix itself. Does anyone really believe they are going to do this? This is an illusory path meant to placate us. We reject this path of stagnation and inaction. We don't act out of fear. We lead with courage. This system must be fixed. Corruption must be uprooted. We must work together to create real change and bring back democracy. Wherever you fit on the political spectrum, from left to right and everything in between, you likely understand how important and urgent it is that we correct the abusive, corrupting nature of money in our political system. I just hope that you also understand how much of an impact your voice and your actions can have on the future of our country and the world. Wolfpack is made up of people from all walks of life, engineers, military veterans, doctors, accountants, farmers, students, lawyers, scientists, mechanics, office managers, and teachers like me. We have all chosen to embark on this necessary journey towards a government where our elected officials represent our values so that we can then fix all of the other pressing issues we hold dearest to our hearts. Let's work together and use the tools of democracy we have at our fingertips to get us there. And that was, bye. That was The Logical Path to End Corruption by Allison Hartson, and a postscript. Joseph Stevenson of Astoria, once a civil rights freedom writer, is a Wolfpack member scornful of political hypocrisy. He says, "We are hearing more and more from the Democratic Party and liberal establishment who are going out of their way to actually lobby against the bills we have been introducing in the state legislatures, while at the same time they fundraise like crazy on the issue of Citizens United and money in politics. Their ideas on how to overturn Citizens United seem to be, one, ask Congress to please take care of this, don't hold your breath, two, wait for enough Supreme Court justices to die or retire, how's that one working out, or three, pass more state laws for campaign finance reform for the Supreme Court to throw out later, because money is speech." Also, it's been interesting, if sometimes appalling, to interact directly with legislators. Finding out how legislation gets passed can be disturbing news, an ugly business that has little to do with majority rule, public opinion, or fairness. And that was Joseph Stevenson. And now, a bit of sublimity by Robert Brake. Throw the rascals out. Guilty of jaw-dropping incivility and mind-boggling obstructionism, the 115th Congress's approval rating is still lower than a snake's belly in a wagon rut. Americans continue to rank cockroaches, head lice, and root canals higher. So when I discovered that, according to one recent poll, 60% of Americans believe we should fire every member of Congress, I created a simple proposal. Let's throw the rascals out. Abolish the 115th Congress and replace it with a national lottery. Not a tongue-in-cheek proposal. It's a simple idea. It is time to thin the herd and eradicate representatives, senators, psychopaths, and fence-sitters, all four of whom may be the same person, who have tossed facts, science, responsibility, and accountability out the window. It's simple. Divide 326 million, current population, by 535, number of representatives and senators. Odds are that one of you can be among the lucky recipients of a $174,000 per year salary, plus perks are just one in 609,000. Those are the odds. That compares favorably to your chance of winning the Publisher's Clearinghouse $5,000 a week forever prize sweepstakes, one in 1,215,500,000. Besides the 714,000 annual salary our so-called representatives enjoy Obamacare, a pension after 5 years, allowances for travel and other expenses, tax deductions and junkets often paid for by bootlicking lobbyists. Now that's a good job, especially when you only work 145 days in 2017, 40% of calendar days, earn $1,200 a day, and can spend at least 1 or 2 days a week phone calling for campaign contributions. The average age of the 115th Congress is 57.8. Over half are businessmen or lawyers, only 20% are women or minorities, 90% are Christian, and over half are millionaires. It's time to correct that imbalance. But, some of you may ask, would infants, adolescents, and young adults be eligible to serve as your representative? Of course. While infants do have language problems, indulge in tantrums, and say no a lot, what makes them so different from our current Congress? NSD, no significant difference. While adolescents may be irresponsible, all-knowing, uninformed, and subject to hormonal rage, what makes them so different? NSD. Young adults and boomers can be greedy, self-centered, and overly ambitious. So, NSD. Seniors often live in the past, want many goods and services, and tend to rust out. Again, NSD. Think of the bounty of benefits of my choose 'em by chance proposal. We would have fewer lawyers, misfits, perverts, lobbyists. Well, maybe not. And older white guys arguing over mathematics, spewing righteous indignation, and making silly rules or disregarding good ones. Truly underrepresented Americans like atheists, barbershop quartets, and Unitarians might finally receive greater representation. We would probably have less provocation, self-loathing, and tin-foiled fantasies, less fine print in our laws, reduced corruption, and diminished cacistocracy. That is cacistocracy, a government run by the worst citizens. we would have more female representatives, more Latinos, African Americans, and other minority representatives, and a younger 115th Congress capable of occasional outbursts of common sense. We might perchance randomly select congressmen and women who actually read bills before they vote on them. We would probably have fewer lunatic fringe representatives like Louis Gohmert, Republican Texas, who claimed that Muslims had taken over the Obama White House, or noted anti-evolutionist Georgia Republican Paul Brown, or Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, Democrat Texas, grandstander extraordinaire and derisively labeled Queen of Mean. And let's not forget former Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, who vigorously advocated intelligent design, opposed same-sex marriage, and loudly asserted that vaccines cause mental retardation. And we would probably have fewer people denying global warming, declaring that we are no longer a racist country, believing that there is such a fuel as clean coal, and asserting that there are alternative facts. I believe that choosing by lottery would really be cool, lots more fun, and a great way to rid ourselves of money-grubbing naysayers. Think about it. Spending billions to elect politicians who we are not very thrilled about usually creates an air of ceremonial futility, the same sense you get while sitting through a very expensive wedding ceremony, celebrating a marriage with decidedly mediocre prospects. The place looks great, and you spared no expense, but our public officials match is only going to last a couple of years, tops, and then it will all end in tears. Wake up, America. I'm through being Mr. Goodbar. It's lottery time. That's all, folks. I need to run. I forgot to put a note on my door advising the prize patrol to leave the check under the doormat. And that was by Dr. Robert Brake. Throw the rascals out. And he is an Ocean Park, Washington freelance writer whose essays and drollery often appear in print in the Chinook Observer and vocally on this program. And I wish to close today's program with a mention of John Seavey. He was a USMC corporal when I knew him. We were friends. We jumped out of airplanes together. And at about the same time I reenlisted for Vietnam in 1965, Seavey became a lieutenant in the Israeli Army. I extended overseas in 1967 after my Vietnam tour to take a job at a USMC base in Japan as editor of the base newspaper. I constantly scanned Vietnam casualty lists looking for the names of friends. I did not expect the letter from Seavey's wife in late June informing me he had been killed in the recent Six-Day War. So I wish to pay tribute to his memory on this 50th anniversary of that war. This has been Michael McCusker. A few words from poet Gwendolyn Brooks, whose centennial birthday was yesterday. We are each other's harvest. We are each other's business. We are each other's magnitude and bond.